This thing doesn't want to show itself. It wants to hide inside an imitation. It'll fight if it has to, but it's vulnerable out in the open. If it takes us over, then it has no more enemies. Nobody left to kill it. And then it's won.
Hello, greetings, welcome everybody. My name is David.
And I'm Tim.
And we want to say thanks for tuning into Johnny Has the Keys podcast. We're so glad you're back with us. It's an examination of horror and science fiction films, television. Each episode will cover some of your favorite movies and maybe some you've never seen, but maybe you should. Giving our opinions on what worked, what didn't work, and what effect it has always had on us. And this week we're really excited because this is like literally our second episode, and we're really excited about the particular movie we're going to be covering this time. What is it, Tim?
Well, we're going to be covering a little movie that came out in 1982 called The Thing. It was directed by John Carpenter, one of my favorite horror movie directors.
Excellent.
This one happens to be more sci-fi horror.
Mm-hmm.
It's based on an original short story by John W. Campbell. It was written and published, I believe, around 1938. He was not known, really, for being a famous science fiction writer. I think he was more known for being an editor. But this story is basically what he's known for now. And it was entitled, Who Goes There?
Who Goes There?
And it's sort of a classic alien-type story with a heavy dose of paranoia as far as who is the alien.
Yeah, and that's one of the things, I mean, because you had urged me to, I actually got the audio tape, you know, you sent to me and listened to the audio book. And it was very, I hadn't read it in a long time. I mean, probably decades. And listening to it again, it was very interesting how much paranoia was really in the story, how much it holds up. I mean, even now, almost, you know, 80 years later, it's still a really great short story with some really cool horror elements to it. But basically, the whole thing of the title kind of says it all. Who goes there? Who do you trust? Which one of us is human? Which one of us isn't? Giving a synopsis or a little synopsis might help everybody. If you haven't read Who Goes There or haven't seen any iteration of The Thing, the basic story is it's a frozen tundra, Antarctica, and or one of the films makes it the North Pole, but Antarctica is from the story. A remote base. They end up answering a distress call and finding something in the ice. It thaws out. It turns out to be a creature from outer space who has the ability to imitate humans or imitate anything, really. And the short story goes into the fact of we think one of us has been imitated. And so that's hence the paranoia that develops from it. What did you think of the story the first time you read it?
Well, of course, I read it after I had seen definitely the John Carpenter movie, maybe even the original Thing from Another World. Is that what it was called, the original 50s movie? I reread it recently, so it's a little bit more in mind, and I was really impressed with how there are strong elements from both movies in the story. Obviously, Carpenter's is a much more literal adaptation of the story as far as the creature being a shapeshifter that can imitate others. And, of course, when he made the movie, special effects were a little bit more sophisticated and they could go there, for lack of a better terminology.
Mm-hmm.
But the element that I thought was also interesting that was in the 50s version is the strong characterizations and the dialogue between the men up at the Arctic Research Station. I could see where Howard Hawks played off of that, trying to get, you know, strong masculine characters. But I saw, you know, where John Carpenter took that further and let the story evolve further than they could with the restrictions they had in the 50s.
Yeah, totally agree. I think one of my notes here about when the first time I you know, listening back to the book again was it's so manly. It is such a masculine story. I mean, yeah. MacReady is so well described in it. I mean, they call him a giant with red eyes. He's a loner. He has his own cabin away from everybody else. He's played up as the decision maker. I love some of the lines from the book. You can tell really inspired Carpenter and his version, much more so, I think, than the Hawks version. I do agree, like with you, that I think he keeps this manlyism in the Hawks version of the movie. But Carpenter literally,
yeah, there's a lot of testosterone going on.
Oh yeah. But he literally, like I took these notes. I said I really love the very first line of the story is the place stank. I just think that's a great opening sentence to a story.
You know, it's so funny that you mentioned that because I was thinking that when I watched the movie. I was like, yeah, it would.
Mm-hmm. Stink. Mm-hmm. Definitely. And,
you know, there's not a lot of fresh air up there because it's cold. So they've got that place closed and it's just filled with men and dogs.
Yeah. Interesting you said men because there's another line I wrote down here from the novel that said, We've got madmen, monsters, and murderers. And I thought that was a great line, too, of this is what it's like. And then later on, because of what MacReady does, the story says, okay, so now meet the only one we know is human because he just murdered somebody. And I was going, oh, okay. Right. See, that says a lot about the human condition and everything else. And then my favorite last line that I put a quote on here is, the blood will not obey. Which is a huge detail that, you know, Howard Hawks' version did not touch at all in any way, except for the fact that the creature feeds on blood, but they don't really do anything as far as testing or any of that, which became so cool in the Carpenter version, in my opinion.
Right.
A key, since we talk about Johnny Has the Keys, a key that I think came from, or that kind of led to who goes there, to me, is Lovecraft's The Mountain of Madness, or In the Mountains of Madness.
Yes, you know, I had not thought of that, but you are absolutely right.
It reminded me of it, and so I looked it up, and it was actually published before Who Goes There. So obviously it may have influenced Campbell. You know, if he had read it at all or anything, but it obviously had something, you know, it may have. But it definitely has that same kind of feel of something buried in the ice that could be alive, and that whole I'm kind of writing my diary to you as I slowly go insane kind of feel.
Right. And to bring it full circle, the creature manifestations in the Carpenter movie were Lovecraftian, and I think he may have even said Lovecraftian influence.
He might have. I mean, in one of the interviews or whatever.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it was him or Bottin, if that's how you pronounce it.
I think it is Bottin.
It seems like I remember one of them mentioning that.
Yeah, I could easily see that. And we'll get to that. We definitely have to talk about the makeup, because that's a huge factor for me in this movie. But before we jump into Carpenter, just a little bit about the 50s version. So, like you had said, the story...
Every man's a manly man, and they all talk fast.
and it's all these winks and nods. I wrote down, you know, there's too many smiles in this movie. There's too many smiles for it to be any kind of preservation of fear at all. They even go, well, Mac, if you want me to walk down to the end of this tunnel... You know, it's like, what?
Everything's A-okay, even though there's a Frankenstein monster wandering around outside somewhere that's going to pop in at any minute.
Right. So what did you think about that? What did you think about, first of all, that decision? Huge decision in this was that the creature is nothing like described in the book. The creature instead is literally, like you said, it's a Frankenstein monster played by James Arness, who's later on going to go be Matt Dillon. But in this, he's just a big supposed giant carrot monster.
Yeah. I don't know, where did the whole vegetable idea come from? I mean, that was a little bit out there.
I know. I think they were just trying to say it has to be something alien to us, and alien to us would be a talking or thinking killing plant. You know, I guess.
I guess my first exposure to this, without having even seen it, I think was from Stephen King's Danse Macabre, where he described him as a giant rutabaga.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't realize that literally he kind of was. What do I think about? I mean, you know, it is what it is. It's a victim of its time. 50s movies, they were basically a little bit down the road from the Universal monster movies, but really not too much. He's tall, he's lurching, he has long fingernails, and he goes, ah. You know, that's what they had. They did try to get the isolation aspect in there. You know, it's a group of men and one woman with a coffee pot in every scene.
Mm-hmm.
basically, you know, having to battle this alien from outer space that looks a lot like a human. You know,
yeah.
Two arms, two legs, and a big head.
Well, now, I did like you said, I think you said it great. You said it, you know, it is a victim of its time, but for its time, I can appreciate it. I like the theremin music kind of being the undertone for it. But then again, one of my favorite all-time movies is The Day the Earth Stood Still, the classic, and it came out the same year as this, like just a few months later. And it too had the theremin soundtrack. Except it was a much more well done film. But I like the.
Isn't it a little more cerebral?
Oh, much so. And very much into more of examining our own culture than running away from, you know, the alien boogeyman who's stuck in the greenhouse. But I do like certain elements of this movie. I do like the chemistry of all the leads and the actors. I think that's really, they've got that 50s banter going back and forth, the very militaristic kind of attitude among all the males. Again, to the point we said earlier, it's a very masculine movie. It's a very we can conquer the world kind of movie to it. The intelligent scientist is portrayed as a guy that we need to get rid of because he's making stupid mistakes.
Doesn't he? He sympathizes with the monster, doesn't he?
Oh, yes. Yeah, so much so it ends up, but it doesn't kill him. It just, as a matter of fact, only two people are killed in the entire movie. And both of those are killed off camera and we don't know about it. Sort of thing. We just hear about it later. So there's no
And the actual monster's only on screen maybe 7 minutes of the entire movie, too.
Yeah, and you would think then if that's the case, then there's going to be so much more atmosphere and it's going to be so much scarier and so much, you know, more terrifying. But it's really not. They don't, to me, create enough of a claustrophobic paranoia. There's no paranoia because there is no shape-shifting. So he's not one of us. He's just something we've got to run away from like an animal.
Right.
Kind of thing. I do like the fact that it's, you know, again, similar to Aliens, the sequel to Alien, they use the Geiger counter as a tracker. So as the creature gets closer to him, the beeps start getting faster and the light starts going faster. So it does create this tension. But really only for one scene. And that's the big scene that has the big burn in it where the monster comes in and they throw the kerosene on and set him on fire, which is a great burn effect, especially in the 50s, because this guy was on fire for like 3 or 4 minutes.
I read somewhere where that was like the first time they had ever done that.
Yeah, which worked great. I mean, it was a great stunt.
Mm-hmm.
I like I said, I do like the banter in it. I do think there's some structural problems with
the movie. There's a lot of it.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of dialogue.
I mean, I'll get into the Carpenter version in a minute, and I'll tell you the strong points I feel that, as far as in regards to both films, I feel where John took it that this film did not.
Agreed. Agreed. I think this one was very, like you said it perfectly, it was of its time. So, and it was also, to me, the first, really, of the 50s bug-eyed monster movies. You know, it was a menace. This was during the height of the Red Scare, and everyone was, you know, terrified that the Ruskies and the commies were going to come get us. And so there was a fear factor out there, and I think Hollywood just kind of personified it then as these alien monsters that were coming to get us. So we have to all band together and stop this threat, which is basically, you know, the underlying story of all of these, but there's so much different permutations to each. I think it's interesting that it's an entire group of military guys, yet the pesky reporter does all the work. I mean, he's the one that helps chip it out of the ice. He boards up all the doors. He helps install the electrical device they fry the rutabaga with at the end. I mean, it's just, I'm going, why is the reporter doing everything?
And that's the best scene.
Which scene?
When they electrocute it at the end. And then it's like the movie's over. It's like instant.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, wow, that was it.
True. Now, it does have very definitive for, you know, science fiction in general, as far as films go. It does have a very definitive ending with Scotty, that reporter character, sitting there saying, watch the skies, keep watching the skies. You know, and it sets up this whole UFO tension thing. So I thought that was a good thing about it. To me, and you're the horror expert, I'm the science fiction expert, if we want to say that, but there wasn't a lot of threat in this movie. It wasn't, to me, a very scary movie, although it supposedly was very scary at the time. But by making it just a creature that we have to either destroy or run away from, we don't understand, as the scientist says, it just kind of took all that paranoia, which was such a major theme in the short story, and just took it away. And it didn't, you know, and re-injecting it the way Carpenter did was so brilliant and made it such a much better film. Oh, there was a trivia piece I wanted to include in this, and it's kind of a key, so to speak, for us. There's a character, and he's the doctor, the white-haired, semi-British doctor who loves the plant. It's his assistant. And the character name I looked up in the credits is called Dr. Voorhees, which I thought would make you giggle. Yes. Yeah. But the cool thing is it's played by an actor named Paul Frees. And Paul Frees, you instantly recognize his voice because he went on to do a million and a half voiceovers and lots of narration. Like, he's the narrator for the War of the Worlds movie. And he is one of the sergeants in The Day the Earth Stood Still. And you just recognize his voice immediately. And he did hundreds of movies in the 50s and 60s as a voice actor. So it was very interesting that he was in the cast. And I was going, oh, okay, I know that voice, and that's who it is. So,
well, that is interesting.
A little trivia there for you.
Yeah, and I can hear that War of the Worlds narration in my head. You know, it's very distinct.
Mm-hmm. And he's great. It's really great. If you listen back to it, you'll hear it instantly. You'll know him.
Okay.
So let's think about this. We've done that, and we've talked about the Hawks version, which we call the Hawks version. It's technically directed by Christian Nyby, but, you know, as you and I have talked about, there's a big debate that maybe Howard Hawks had a little bit more to do with the direction than just being the producer, similar to the Spielberg-Toby Hooper thing on Poltergeist.
Right.
But so then the story kind of just went away for like a few decades. And then John Carpenter decided to make a movie. John Carpenter, who had done horror movies, who, you know, most of the world knew from Halloween, now was going to do a new film and a big budget film. Wasn't it his first major studio film?
It was. It was definitely his biggest budget.
Okay.
At the time.
And it was Universal again, because they controlled the property. I found out in doing my research for our wonderful podcast that he had worked with Rob Bottin before.
Oh, really? actually, you know that this was not a Carpenter project to begin with either.
No,
it bounced around for a couple of years. Toby Hooper was originally attached to it because he was more famous at the time when it first originated. But
really?
Then after Halloween came, yeah, I was reading this earlier today. I was trying to think, and I don't. There is a long list of other actors that were considered for these roles. I don't know if you've seen that either.
I have not.
Oh my God! I should have wrote all this down. Lee Van Cleef was considered for Gary because he had done Escape from New York with Carpenter. And Isaac Hayes, who was also in Escape from New York, was considered for Childs.
Okay.
There was a ton of people that were considered for MacReady because he was at one point trying to get away from Kurt Russell because they had already done two films together. Of course, they went on to do another one with Big Trouble. Jeff Bridges was considered. I read somewhere that Bruce Willis was considered, and I find that a little bit out there because he really wasn't around until 1985 on television, and this came out long before that.
Right.
So I'm not sure I believe that one. But Sam Elliott, I mean, a lot of those like macho type actors of that era were considered for the role as well. And several turned it down, too. I wonder what they think about that now.
What do you think about the casting that he finally decided on?
The movie's so ingrained in me that I find it hard to consider anybody else than who's already in this movie.
Oh, I think it's brilliant. I mean, I love the casting. I love the fact that there's so many faces that you don't really recognize, which kind of gives them
right.
their own characterization. And then there's a couple that you know, like Wilford Brimley. He wasn't really known at that time. Cocoon had not come out yet, which was his big hit.
And guess who he was? Guess who could have been him?
I don't know.
Donald Pleasance. That's who they were considering. No, I know. I mean, I love Donald Pleasance, but there is no way he could have done that role as good as Wilford Brimley did it.
No, there's no way. Not at all. And I think, and Kurt Russell, the computer wore tennis shoes, the big Disney guy, and suddenly to give him a role of this kind of strength and power was really, really brilliant, I think, because he really pulled it off very well.
Yeah.
I looked up this. Rob Bottin and Carpenter had just worked 2 years earlier on The Fog. They had worked together. Rob Bottin did all the makeup effects for The Fog.
Okay.
So that's how they knew each other, and that's why Carpenter wanted him on board for this, because they had talked a little bit about it, or about that the kind of creature design that he wanted during The Fog when they were filming it. So.
That's wild, because he was 22 when he did The Thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that means he was probably a teenager when he was working on The Fog.
Correct. He was only 20 when he did The Howling, which he revolutionized bladder control and all the stuff he was doing with the whole...
That's right. I forgot about that.
You know, the whole bones breaking, using bladders to change and transform people, which worked great. Let's see, who are the... Oh, the other one, that cast member that I really, really like in... Well, I like the entire cast, by the way, for Carpenters. I liked literally every character in it and every actor in it. And I'm kind of like...
I know, and whenever I see them... Sorry, I didn't mean...
No, go ahead.
But whenever I see them in anything else, I'm like, oh, he was in The Thing. Mm-hmm. You know, like I've seen Gary, the guy that played Gary, in a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of stuff. And, of course, T.K. Carter went on to do, like, television. Richard Masur has been around forever.
Yeah, see, and he's the one I was going to mention because really think his part's great for only like the 8 lines that he may get in the entire movie, but he plays it so well and comes off so as such a compassionate and cool character. But I remembered him from One Day at a Time, the series, you know, and so suddenly to see him in this pseudo macho part,
and to have one of the best lines in the movie too.
I don't know what the hell's in there. It's weird and pissed off, whatever it is.
So, let's try something. I'm going to say some characters. And I want to say the character, and you tell me something that imprinted you about them. MacReady.
I think that MacReady's character was set up in his very first scene where he's playing chess with the computer and it wins, and he dumps the drink in the computer and says, "Cheating bitch," and walks away.
Mm-hmm.
I think that right there tells you this guy doesn't like to lose. And there are several other scenes in the movie where that is reinforced.
Yes, and I agree with you. I think it sets his character up very well, but it's really one of the few moments in this movie that I think is a miss that I don't like. I just don't buy the whole fact
because he ruined the computer.
Yeah, that you're stuck up here for all winter with nobody, and you're going to pour your precious scotch that you love into the computer and destroy it. I don't think so. No matter how drunk or crazy you may be. So that one kind of me seemed very cliche and kind of, you know, war gamesy to me. But yeah, I definitely agree. I think it sets his character as.
I think that was the sacrifice they made.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, let's show this guy's character as briefly as we can, you know, and I guess they, you know, obviously used to something that wasn't very logical, but
yes.
It worked.
Yeah. But again, MacReady to me, I mean, he's very inspired by the novel, I think, because he is the masculine one. He's the tough one. He does have his own little cabin out by himself. He's almost like the lone wolf kind of guy. He's the only helicopter pilot. So he's the only guy that could literally fly them out or help them if they wanted to, sort of thing.
He wears a stupid hat.
I disagree. I love the hat. I think the hat's brilliant. I think it's a great idea.
I think it was a practical joke. Well, you know how that happened, right?
No.
It got filmed in second unit before Kurt Russell was on board. He was forced into it.
Nuh-uh.
Yeah, that's what it said. When I listened to the commentary with him and Carpenter, that's what he said. That basically the hat, some long shots they did.
Right, for the map paintings and everything were shot second unit, and they left him in the hat. Oh, yeah, okay. I could see that then.
And then when he got on board, you know, they were like, you have to wear this hat. It's already been used.
Uh-huh.
If not, I mean, it sounds like a great practical joke, but I don't know. They laugh about it.
Interesting. That's really cool.
It's a dorky hat.
I think it's just cool, though. It's such a statement of, I don't really care who cares about my hat. I really don't care, you know, kind of.
It's really about keeping your head warm. Yeah. Yeah.
So character-wise, stick to that for just a second. So I love, you know, a lot of the names are the same names from the novel, too. So Carpenter's going back to the source material, which I think is great. Almost all the characters are, like, to your point, MacReady's is, too, but I think almost all the characters are portrayed extremely well in almost their first scene, first or second scene, you know, and each given a little character trait that's kind of unique that sets them apart, from the roller skates that Knowles is on as the chef to... Obviously, Palmer's the stoner because he's literally getting high as it starts. The fact that Gary, just the way, without even dialogue and anything, you know that he's a timid, scared kind of commander.
Do you think so?
Yeah, you get this kind of, he's not comfortable being the leader.
But he's the one that breaks the window and shoots the guy.
He does. He shoots the Norwegian and takes initiative there. But, you know, throughout the rest of it, he's very similar to the Gary from the novel, who is, I may be the de facto leader, but I'm not your leader, really. I'm not as strong as the rest of you, kind of thing. Even though he does have
He knows when to step down, for sure.
Yeah, and he has one of the, you know, one of the best lines in the whole movie, which we'll get to, I'm sure. But
they all have a memorable line. They really do.
From the very beginning, from the black screen, and you hear that incredibly good music and that theme. And then suddenly we are white blinded with the helicopter and we're chasing a dog and we're shooting at it. That's just such a unique kind of what's going, I'm not really sure what's happening, and it's not the most comfortable situation I've ever seen, you know?
And why is that guy such a bad shot?
Well, that's true, too. I was going to have a note here that says he's obviously training to be a stormtrooper because he cannot shoot anything.
Mm-mm.
Even with a rifle literally like 10 yards from somebody. But it's such a great teaser to have. We're chasing this dog. We're shooting this dog. And then I commend Carpenter so much because the scenes with that dog in the beginning of that movie are so creepy to me. It just shows them in the rec room partying or talking or whatever, and the camera just pans down and you just see in the corner at the doorway the dog's just sitting there looking at them all. And the dog doesn't do anything. It's not threatening, but it just is, with the music, it's so creepy to me.
That actually brings me to what I was going to mention earlier, as far as a difference between Carpenter's and the Howard Hawks version, is whereas it's like the 50s movie is uncomfortable with silence, so they're going to have this, you know, kooky dialogue, for lack of better words, where, you know, there's constant dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Carpenter version, he sets up the suspense immediately with no dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
There are, you know, there's long shots. And it continues throughout the film, like you said, when the dog's walking down the hall and stuff. But what I'm thinking of is you've got the spaceship, the title. Then you've got the snow. You've got the helicopter, the dog. There may be little snippets of dialogue around camp. Like, you know, why is this guy shooting the dog or whatever. But then to pepper it with just the right amount of the clever dialogue that the 50s film does after that huge long introduction scene, the scene ends with MacReady saying, "Great first goddamn week of winter."
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, wow. That was it's like a punctuation mark to the first 10 minutes of that movie. And he does that several times in the film, you know, with the "you gotta be fucking kidding" line and, you know, "let's stick around for a while and see what happens." All these great scenes have little punctuation marks of dialogue, which to me echoes back to the Howard Hawks version. Almost as an homage.
It is, because I think it's clever dialogue, but I think it's more character-driven dialogue, which is better. Less repartee, witty, Whit and Perry kind of stuff. And also very cleverly paced, to your point. It's used as punctuation, or it's used in the middle of a scene to kind of pump the scene or get it going into the next sequence. He also does something really clever screenplay-wise in this, in that he uses fades. He'll fade out of a scene and go to black and then either cut or fade into a different scene rather than a hard cut or a lap dissolve. So, and he also ends a lot of these scenes with a question. A lot of these scenes, like, I remember one where the character, and I think it's Child, is looking at Blair and says something like, "You buy any of this shit, Blair?" And it cuts to Blair and then suddenly just fades out. He never answers the question.
Yeah.
And there's two or three of those times where he'll end a scene with a question, and it kind of leaves us with a question watching it.
Yeah. And he'll fade to white
too. Mm-hmm. He'll do white outs.
And he got grief for that. I heard that in the commentary as well. Some people said, "You don't need to do that. Don't do that." And he fought for that. He wanted those.
Oh, his pacing is so great in this, and it harkens back to Halloween, The Fog. I mean, some of his classics, that his pace all the way through is just this, it's plodding almost, in that it's relentless. And it just keeps going and keeps going. You're going, oh my gosh, it's got to be ending now. No, it's not. We're still going.
Yeah, and there's some direct echoes of Halloween in it, where he'll show shots of like a hall or a barrack or something, and it's just like in Halloween, where he shows that staircase and that room or that place where that person was murdered. It's like, you know, little scenes just little still shots, and it just creates again that suspense that we were talking about.
Well, and you said it perfect, because I keep remembering that beginning, and the initial dog stuff, and then the great, first goddamn week of winter, and it goes to white, and then we're with them in the rec room, and we're having their fun, and then we're showing this, just getting kind of our bearings of the complex or the base. So he shows empty surgical suite or empty med bay, an empty kind of kitchen, an empty hallway, and then he holds on another empty hallway and holds on it a little bit too long, and you're going, why is it, and all of a sudden in the very back of it you see the dog, and he just walks down the hallway and just very innocently,
it's
just
so perfect,
walks into a room, and you see a shadow turn, and then it goes, fades out. And this is before the action's even started. They haven't even been to the Norwegian base yet or anything. This is just all a teaser. Which reminds me, I have a question for you. So that shadow that turns, I mean, it's very heavily implied that's the first person, because this is before anybody suspects anything. So that's probably the first person that the thing takes over and inhabits. Who do you think that was?
Well, logic would say that it's either Palmer or Norris. The shadow looks a little bit like Norris, but I read the other day where he didn't let any of the actors play that shadow because he didn't want anybody to look too familiar. And I think it ended up being maybe Kurt Russell's double that did that.
Cool. Great trivia. That is really neat. I did not know that, but I love the fact that he left it ambiguous.
Yeah, he didn't want any of the actors to do it.
Yeah, for those of us who are like on second, third, or for, you and I are 50th viewing of this film, it's neat to see those moments when you're trying to figure out the things, actions that you don't see or do see. How does it do this? What's it thinking? Where's it going? That kind of stuff. I mean, to me, I think that was Norris. Because, and I'll tell you why, I always have assumed since the very first time I saw this that the thing, replicates people perfectly. So if you ended up having a disease or a problem or whatever, it would replicate it because it doesn't know the difference. So I don't think the thing knew that Norris had a heart condition.
Right.
And so that's what, that's why its real first appearance on the base to them, it couldn't prevent. It couldn't help. Something that the prequel does not do. It tends to just do everything all the time. Which we'll get to once we talk about it. But other than the dogs, the first human real giveaway is the big Norris scene. Again, a makeup tour de force. But so I think I think the dog that was Norris, and Norris the entire time that he's going through everything else, even to the point of Gary saying, "Norris, I think you should be in charge," and he goes, "No, I don't think I should." That's really the thing.
Yeah, I can see that. I also heard or read somewhere where they said that if it was Palmer, then that means the alien was high the entire film.
Yeah, most of it he'd have to be, I would think.
because Palmer's stoned the whole time.
Oh yeah, the entire time. I took a note here too. From the very beginning of this film, the Carpenter film, what I really love too, again, comparing it to the Hawks Nibby version, everything looks so real. It's real snow. It's real helicopters. It's real dogs. You look at the Nibby version, and all the icicles on the buildings are the same size and the same distance apart. So obviously, this is a fake set, and the snow that's blowing around them is always going the same direction. So it's obviously a filter, that they've put over them, and they're not really cold and everything. And there's such realism that Carpenter put in the very beginning of this. When MacReady and the doc go to the Norwegian camp, you can see their breath the entire time. It's really cold. the sets were cold to make that happen, you know. And it, a lot of it has to do with Dean Cundey, who I cannot ever say enough about, because I think he's a brilliant cinematographer. Worked with Carpenter on almost every movie he did, but several other directors too. He worked with Spielberg a couple of times. He's just a brilliant, the lighting, the cinematography, just some great, great work in this movie.
Yeah, the blue lighting in this movie on the snow is just so beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
With the blues and the shadows.
The fire effects, the flare lighting. You know, mm-hmm. when MacReady's holding the dynamite with the flare, and just the way it's just in his eyes and everything. I love the shot. It's one of my favorite shots in history, of when they find the victim in the Norwegian camp, and he's slit his own throat and frozen to death at the same time. And the way they cut to that one shot and the camera pans down, it's just his hand with the, like, the blood sickles hanging off of it that are frozen, and the flashlight's hitting it from behind, so it's almost in silhouette, but you can see the red of the... it's just a great shot. I've just always loved it.
Yeah, it is awesome. But I do have a question, and I've never really thought about this until I watched this movie the other day. Is if they're just now chasing that dog in the helicopter, how come that place is so frozen and already, like, abandoned when it's really only been a day or so?
Agreed. Well, to me...
And I had never really thought of that.
Well, I thought the same thing, because it would have to be, like, insta-freeze. Because how could you literally cut yourself and freeze mid-bleeding? Kind of thing, you know. How would you get blood sickles?
Well, and disregarding that victim, but I mean, just look at the set. I'm looking at a picture of it right now. There's, like, ice on this typewriter. There's icicles everywhere. It's almost as if the place has been abandoned for a month, not a day.
Correct.
It's just, it's weird. I mean, I know it's storytelling and you have to do stuff like that. It never really occurred to me until the last time that I watched it. I was like, wow, how did that happen so fast?
Well, and there could be a supposition that the two Norwegians, the helicopter pilot and the shooter, thought that everything was fine until they saw one of the dogs. So this could have been, you know, to me, I always rationalized it as this had been abandoned, or this tragedy had happened at the camp maybe at least a week before they actually started hunting the dog.
Maybe so.
It was kind of like but again, I think that may be my just justification of it. But that's kind of the way I always took it. But I'm the same as you. You know, everything in this camp is completely frozen over and destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
It adds to the fear factor, I think, and the creepiness. And, again, sets it up as this could happen to us kind of bad thing. But it's just a... but it doesn't make rational sense, to your point. I agree.
Oh, here's my note. Nick Nolte, Harrison Ford, and Clint Eastwood were all considered, too.
For MacReady?
Yeah, and Fred Ward campaigned for it, and he didn't get it.
Good.
Yeah. And that's just some. I mean, if you Google it, you'll see a list of others. Like I said, I saw Bruce Willis, which I thought was a little far-fetched. I was just going to throw something out there. We were talking about suspense and who was first... known, or who we thought that shadow was that could potentially be the first victim of the thing in this film. I read something interesting over this past week where the characters were constantly asking questions of themselves. You know, if you were the thing, what would, you know, this mean, and what would you do?
Uh-huh.
And it's really interesting upon multiple viewings, where you know who the thing is, like, you know it's Palmer and you know it's Norris, watch how they act. Notice how they start deflecting suspicion on MacReady.
Mm-hmm.
They're constantly trying to deflect it away from themselves.
Yep. Good
point. It's interesting.
It is, and I think that helps it in the second, third, you know, to us 50th viewing, is seeing all those nuances and seeing, okay, if he really is the thing right now, then he is literally, you know, manipulating this. I agree. That's a great point.
Mm-hmm.
And it helps with the paranoia too. One of the, you know, the, as we've said, the great thing about this movie is they immediately start suspecting each other. And there's a total breakdown of trust between them. Except to your point about punctuation, Carpenter leaves some people. He leaves some people to be like our compassionate heroes, like a Windows. The one that we never see die, but we assume dies, Fuchs, who always seems like the nice MacReady, I need to talk to you, I need to help you. You know, we kind of want to sympathize with him, and then suddenly he dies.
And Knowles, too. Knowles vanishes, and you never know what happens to him either.
That's right. That's right. There's quite a few. There's Knowles, Fuchs. I mean, the people we don't see die, because the deaths that we do see are pretty extreme. You know, Norris, Bennings.
Clark.
But Knowles, we never see die. Fuchs. And, of course, Childs and MacReady, because of that phenomenal ending. But so many... Okay. So going back, so many things that are so good about it. The pacing's great. The cinematography's great. I think it's really cool that he got Albert Whitlock to do the matte paintings, because he's so well known and was so well known at this time in Hollywood for doing these incredible matte shots. Went on to work on all the Star Wars movies and did some great work by adding little touches. So it's not just the matte painting. It's the matte painting with the sun and the shadow going over the spaceship. So it adds that realism to the whole thing. The music cannot be discounted or accentuated enough in this movie. I think it is one of the best soundtracks ever.
Something Carpenter's always used as far as suspense. He's always been really good with music.
Yeah, I read that this was one of the first times he didn't do his own music.
Right.
Morricone did it and really did not collaborate with Carpenter on it at all.
But he did do it with an electric synthesizer, because he knew Carpenter was fond of that.
Correct. And Carpenter did a great job. I mean, we all love the theme to Halloween as well. And The Fog. Mm-hmm. The Fog has great music. Assault on Precinct 13 has great music. All done by Carpenter. So,
And all done effectively with his photography. Like, you know, when we were referring to generating suspense earlier with the still shots and the long shots. The music just adds to that. I mean, it's perfect.
And he does such a great job in the shot, not only just the shot structure and his pacing, but the screenplay and everything of creating these characters that we care about. So we actually have time to get to know them a little bit very quickly, and we get time to care about them before bad things start happening. I like the fact that they don't do the Howard Hawks approach with the bleeding heart scientist who wants to keep the alien alive or talk to it because it's our first touch with a civilization. And they don't do the greedy thing of we're all going to become millionaires because we found the first, you know, alien life form. I think there's even only one reference to that. Bennings, or I think it's Bennings. Yeah. Before he gets taken over, says, you can't destroy the find of the century. Or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But he's the one that got shot. But right. Yeah, but that's really... Yeah, he's the one with the great... I'm kneeling in the snow with my claw hands, screaming at you.
And the invasion of the body snatcher scream.
Yes. Which, and there you go. That's a huge key for this movie. Invasion of the body snatchers? Oh my gosh.
Well, I mean, in more than one way. I mean, that scene is a direct ripoff of a movie that came out 4 years earlier.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So true.
Yeah, big time.
So true. And very...
It's just not Donald Sutherland pointing.
Yeah. Invasion of the Body Snatchers. We'll cover that at the end. We'll cover the keys. But I do think it's that whole paranoia, that contagion, that the feeling that we're being taken over by something that we can't control. And then when we find out it imitates and looks just like us, then we don't know who to trust. So that breaks it down anymore. If we wanted to compare them, I think for the men, it's this will to survive sort of thing. In the Howard Hawks version, it's if we all pull together, we can defeat this thing.
Triumph.
And in the Carpenter one, it's more or less, you know, every man for himself kind of thing. I don't trust anybody else. I trust me, but I don't trust you guys. With the exception of the MacReady, who actually is trying to defend it for everybody kind of thing. He's not played as a total selfish, you know, loser kind of thing.
And that's more of a, it brings more of a realism to it and less of a Hollywood to it.
Yeah.
Because people don't act like those guys in the 50s. They really don't. I mean, even in the 50s, I don't think they did. I think they acted more like the guys on Mad Men.
Right. Yep. I agree. And I think, but I think it's really unique that the underlying theme of the entire Carpenter movie is we'll survive. We've all got to survive. The men are naturally all wanting to survive and stay human. The thing is wanting to survive. And that's why I think it's so cool that he made the ending choice that he did. Since the thematic all the way through is we're going to survive.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've talked about the makeup a little bit. Bautin's makeup was phenomenal all the way through.
Well, yeah, I was going to say we should probably touch on that at least a little bit. When the creature's not imitating somebody, it is something completely off the charts, out of this world.
Literally, that people had not seen at all, I don't think, in films before this. I mean, we had seen some transformations in The Howling and that kind of stuff, but to be this graphic, I've read here that Leonard Maltin, the big reviewer, because the thing mm-hmm. Carpenter's didn't get great reviews when it first came out.
Ebert didn't like it either.
And I wrote down that one of the things he said was, this is an endless parade of slimy creatures.
Mm-hmm. Ebert said the characters were superficial, which is totally wrong.
Now there has been, you know, a lot of retcon and people going back and now changing all that now. And I think it is mm-hmm. a classic now. But and I've read all these influences that might have contributed to that. This was released like 2 months before E.T. So right. Once E.T. hit the, you know, the total opposite of, instead of an evil alien who wants to imitate us all and take over, it's a cute little sweet alien who just wants to go home.
Actually, I think it was after E.T. I think people were still going to see E.T., which took away from its audience. And it was Blade Runner 2. Both of them came out like the same weekend, I think. And E.T. just stole all their viewers, potential viewers.
Yeah. Yeah, and people weren't ready for, you know, since we've seen a nice, happy, sweet monster, an alien, we don't want an evil alien. But mm-hmm. I think, in sense, and, you know, again, watching it just literally yesterday, this movie still holds up really well.
Oh, yeah.
It's still very scary. It's still very cutting edge in the way it's filmed and shot. Still very well done. Going back to the makeup. So, Rob Bottin did all the makeup effects with his team except for the dogs.
The very first one, yeah.
Yeah, and that was because they were so far behind in getting the rest of the effects where they wanted and everything else, so he called in Stan Winston.
He was actually hospitalized for exhaustion, too, which is another reason they brought Stan in.
Yeah, and Stan Winston did the dog sequence, which again is a very well done sequence, effect sequence. Just in the way it's, again, that dog creeps me out. I just never want that to see a dog like that again. But when Clark lets it in and just says, go on, and it goes in and just lays down right near the door, and he closes the door and starts to walk off, and it just lays there.
It's a great scene.
And then suddenly all the other dogs start reacting to it. It hasn't done anything yet, but they're all going, you know, and moving back and everything. And I'm going, oh no. And then its whole head rips open. So you go, okay, didn't expect that. But very much a great effect sequence. I think that sequence, and then of course the next big sequence is Bennings, but the operating autopsy scene is the operating scene where they're trying to revive Norris. And
do you think that it got mad because he shocked it So that time, the second time he comes down to shock it again, it's like, well, screw you, man. I'm just going to bite your arms off.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you be shocking me.
I'll show you shocking. But and that scene to me just keeps building and building and building, because it's, okay, now my hands are inside. Then all of a sudden it bites my arms off. Then I fall down. Then MacReady's looking at it, and all of a sudden all these tendrils start shooting out of the chest. Then they go up on the ceiling, and it's got Norris's face with this weird kind of spidery thing protruding.
It looks like
there.
A fleshy antenna, but yeah.
Yeah, and so he...
Like an old rabbit ears antenna kind of thing.
Yeah, and he burns it, and then we suddenly go, okay, well, so that's it. He's burned it just like we burned Bennings, and just like we've burned, you know, the Norwegians burned everybody, so we're good. Oh, no, no. His head's going to stretch, not just cut off. It's going to stretch and pop off. It's going to slink down the side of the desk.
And that's one of the most realistic things to me in the entire movie.
Mm-hmm.
That head looks so real to me when it is sliding off the table and going to the floor.
And then so I think, okay, that's as far as that can go. No, no, now the tongue's going to come out, turn into a really, really long, like a frog tongue, pull the head over underneath the desk, and then we get the great crab legs and the antenna eyes and everything. Mm-hmm. It was just awesome. I loved it. And it's capped by Palmer's line, which, you know... He turns and sees it before MacReady does. Goes, you got to be fucking kidding me.
Yeah, and it's like what I was saying earlier. It's one of those long, action-packed, very little dialogue scenes. Just, you know, minimal yelling in the background or whatever. And then mm-hmm. it's punctuated with that line at the end.
Perfect. It's perfect.
Yeah. And well, actually, the dot of the punctuation mark is the flamethrower. But yeah.
Yes. Yeah, very well said. That's the dot, or the exclamation point at the end, yes.
Yeah.
And then the next, I guess, effect sequence we have, if we're going to talk about them, is Palmer.
Blair Monster. Or,
no, it's
oh,
Palmer.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about Palmer.
And the whole Palmer and Windows, and I'm going to bite your head off, and then I'm going to throw you in the corner, and which is great. It was such a great fitting in to Windows, who... was such a sympathetic character all the way through, even down to everybody yelling at him about, you know, get somebody on the horn and...
Reach anybody. We're 1,000 miles from nowhere, man, and it's going to get a hell of a lot worse before it gets any better.
Do you think it's a coincidence that there's a character named Mac and a character named Windows?
Oh, my gosh. I'd never thought of that, but...
I mean, it was 1982.
True.
It could be coincidence.
Could be, but it'd be a cool kind of coincidence if it was.
Yeah.
That's pretty sweet, actually.
But yeah, Windows gets eaten by like a giant Venus flytrap Palmer kind of thing. And that's where they add the homage scene of the creature being on fire going outside.
Yes. Again, another burn effect, which looked really good, really great, going outside. Then the total illogic of, okay, we just spent 20 minutes saying that every part of this thing wants to be alive, even the blood, and da da da. So I'm going to throw dynamite at it and blow it into a million little pieces.
That's exactly what I thought. Let's blow it into a million pieces.
Each one of them wanting to live. I have issues with that. Okay.
I mean, if you're going to finish the makeup conversation, you've got the Blair Monster at the end.
Right, but before that, you have one of my favorites, which is the Gary with his face stretched out. You know, because when Blair
okay.
When Blair catches Gary, he keeps him quiet by literally distorting his whole face with his hand inside his mouth, kind of thing.
And inside my head, I imagine there's something coming out of his palm and going down his throat, too, probably.
Oh,
kinda
yeah.
Like Alien.
I kind of thought that, too, the very Alien-inspired thing.
Yeah, very Alien-inspired, as a matter of fact.
Yes.
Now that you mention it.
And then the Blair Monster, which is, again, they really culmination effect, because it has a dog in it, it has Blair, it has the whole kind of tendrily, spidery antenna thing.
It's got something that looks like a T-Rex head, too.
Yeah, so he kind of like throws the whole kitchen sink at everything there. But to me, best makeup in the movie is when Windows cuts Nall's finger and it hurts so bad. And then he cuts his own the other way. That just it hurts me when I see it. I go, I think it's what Eli Roth likes about the movie best, probably, because it's painful. Great lines. I have another thing here that just has a list of great lines. Like you said, we've got the, you gotta be fucking kidding me, first weekend of winter.
I know you gentlemen have been through a lot, and when you find the time, I'd rather not spend the rest of this winter tied to this fucking couch!
Yes, that's great.
Yeah.
Chariots of the Gods, man. They practically own South America. That was... but such great... And then, you know, which makes you a murderer, don't it? When they all find out that he killed... McCready killed Clark and Clark wasn't infected. Yeah, and then the...
I really like Clark's character. I like that he is more sympathetic to the dogs than he is to the humans.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he strongly suspects McCready. I mean, he's the one going for that scalpel. He's going to get him, you know.
Yeah, and again, established so well at the very beginning, he's the one that kneels down beside the dog and doesn't really say anything, just kind of pets it while he's looking off at the Norwegian, you know, kind of thing. So that's, it's just a great setup, great character. Childs, I like Childs' character too, all the way through it. He's portrayed as this kind of badass, literally always challenging McCready, always challenging everything, and yet he's one of the survivors at the end. And his and McCready's last line about, you know, well, maybe we shouldn't. Why don't we, and what's it, what's McCready's last line? Something like, why don't we just wait here a little while? And then the music starts.
Or something.
And see what happens.
Or no, something like that. Or maybe I'm adding that. Maybe he does just say, wait here a while.
And then you just hear the boom, boom, dum, dum, you know, of the music again. I just, it's a great movie. It's just so well done. I did, though, have some questions or some thoughts about it. At the very beginning, the sign says Station 4 when the dog passes it. Says U.S. Arctic Station 4 or whatever. Yet Windows, when he's on the phone, says this is U.S. 31. And McCready, when he's doing his report, says U.S. 31. So it's a different station than what the sign actually says. So I thought that was a kind of a goof or something that was odd about it. I take issue with the fact that they make a huge statement about the fact that the bodies that they retrieve from the Norwegian are still alive. He said they're not dead yet, because that's how Blair determines the whole thing about the fact that they're imitating. Right?
Oh, I missed that.
He does the simulation and all that. So that's why they say we're going to burn them all, and we're going to put them all in the, you know, so they take all the bodies. They even take the blood bags later and they burn everything.
Right. I do remember that.
So the whole point is, and just like correct my logic if I'm wrong. So the whole point is we burn it until it just doesn't move anymore and it's inert. And then later on we take it out and we really, really burn it. Because they're using the flamethrower as their primary source of defense.
Yeah, but they keep having to use fire extinguishers because they don't want to burn their building down.
Right. Until, like, which leads to my big question, which leads to this whole logic of the end. I don't understand the end. Because McCready makes this big sentence about, or this big scene about, it doesn't care anymore. It wants to freeze because it can be thawed out again. So it wants us all to die. So then his logic with Knowles and Gary is, then let's blow the whole place up and let's burn it all down. Unless they kill it, it's just going to freeze again. So what's the point in blowing everything up? Other than it looks cool with them throwing Molotov cocktails and running down the hallway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought that was a plot hole that was weird. I think there's a weird plot hole in the fact that they're all outside. and they mention the blood. And if you look around, none of them is infected unless you think Palmer has been infected by then. Because Norris is already dead. So Palmer would be the only one that's still the thing. But they talk about, we're going to do a test with the blood. And then the very next cut is them walking over to the safe and all the blood has been destroyed. Yet none of them knew anything. None of them could have gotten to the blood.
Well, Gary had access.
But Gary's never been infected.
I know. That's why that didn't make sense. It was kind of like a red herring, you know. He's the one that had the keys.
Right.
And that's why MacReady wants to test him. He says, you know, you're the only one that had access to that blood.
Right. Which, again, is one of those where I was going, it doesn't really, I'm not really sure I understand that.
Yeah, it's very Agatha Christie.
Yeah. Kind of is throwing it, you know, a far, you know, the whole Blair had enough time to build this workshop underneath the tool shed, go out, get helicopter parts, bring them back into the tool shed and build a baby spaceship that was almost finished, it looked like, by the time they found it. That seems weird
to me.
That to me
is the most illogical thing, is that little spaceship. But hey, speaking of Agatha Christie, what about when Knowles and MacReady go to check out his shack because he didn't turn the lights off the night before or something, and they're on.
Mm-hmm.
And then Knowles cuts him loose out in the snow and comes in half frozen saying, I cut him loose because I found this. And he's got this burnt remnant of a MacReady uniform with his name on it. I'm like, who did that? When did that happen?
Right. And remember, before that, even Fuchs found it. Fuchs found it outside right before he's burned by whoever burns him, by whichever thing burns him.
Like when he's looking at the helicopter or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. And okay, so that's a good point. And I think this may be just an editing issue, but like before Knowles comes in, it shows Childs looking out the windows. One of them is looking out the window and they can see MacReady's shack. From looking out the window. So if it's that close that I can see MacReady's shack, then cutting him loose here won't make a damn bit of difference because he can still walk the other 50 freaking feet to get to the door.
And that, I mean, you know, you don't need a rope to see that far. That is pretty well lit. And back to the clothing stuff, Knowles also mentions earlier on, who's putting their dirty drawers in my kitchen trash or whatever. So I mean, it's brought up more than once. So how does this thing, I mean, I guess when it's changing, it has to dispose of the clothes and then I guess perfectly replicate the clothing, you know, because technically they're going to be, you know, they're not running around naked,
right? They would have to find other clothes and then get rid of the clothes and the blood that it leaves when it's replicating, kind of thing.
That's a little more that suspension of disbelief.
Right. That and the fact that you mentioned the long johns. One of the things that, another one of my kind of plot holes is MacReady's doing his big lengthy tape recorder thing where he says, I'm leaving this, I'm going to hide this tape just in case anything happens, somebody will have a record and yada yada. One of the things he says is, Windows found some torn, you know, he says, and I think it has to tear through your clothes when it imitates you, because Windows...
He does say that.
He says Windows found some long johns that were ripped up. Windows didn't find them. Knowles found them. So...
Oh, yeah. Well,
to your point.
Drunk on scotch.
Yeah, that's true. Because he also says, when they're all outside, he says, there's going to be a storm hitting us in 6 hours, and we're all going to see who's who. One of my favorite lines, by the way. But then it immediately cuts, and he's in his room recording, and he goes, the storm's been hitting us hard now for 48 hours. Wait, has it been 2 days, literally? So we kept these guys tied to a couch on morphine for 2 days? What?
Yeah. And those shots are great when they keep proving people are not the thing, and it's like, it's, you know, there's less and less people on the couch until finally it's just Gary, and he looks so sad tied there to that couch.
I know. It's so good.
It's awesome.
It's so awesome.
And then when they test it, you know, Childs, I think, standing there with a flamethrower and someone else is on the other side of MacReady, and then nothing happens, and they both just stand there like guilty kids, you know, who've just done something really bad.
Yeah. Oops. We didn't mean to.
Yeah. Yeah, there's so much humor in this movie, too.
It is.
They're not Swedes, Mac. They're Norwegian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Good stuff. And great performances. I mean, there's really not one flawed performance in it. You know, usually in a film, I can make one and go, why did he say that line that way? Or, oh, why did they cast that guy? This is just so well done all the way through it.
Yeah.
And I think it's... He left the excess to the makeup department. And he did what he does best, which is this slow burn paranoia. Something's coming and we don't know where and when it will be here. Kind of fear factor all the way through it. And lets these great performances play out. Doesn't linger a lot. He does a lot of close-ups in this. You know, I know that... Silence of the Lambs won the Oscars and everything else. And one of the big things everybody kept saying about it was Jonathan Demme used close-ups much more so than he ever should have. And I was thinking, you know, when I even read that, I thought back to, you know, there's a lot of close-ups in the thing. There's a lot of headshots of just people's eyes looking at each other and how they, you know, what they're thinking and everything else. So I think it's just very brilliantly directed all the way through.
Well, and, you know, they filmed it on location, and it was a bunch of guys, so I'm sure there was a little bit of camaraderie going on. I mean, I'm sure it was kind of a really fun experience behind the scenes, too. I think it looks like they bonded. It shows in the characterizations they play.
Definitely.
Do you agree?
Definitely.
Yeah. I mean, I would have loved to have been a part of that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so... While we're there, so we've done Carpenter, we love Carpenter, and we know Carpenter is a key to a later film, the 2011 film, which ironically has the exact same title.
Yeah, that is strange.
Which is my first beef against it, which is I don't really understand why they kept the title, the thing, for the thing. It seems like you could have maybe used the Norwegian word for thing. I don't know.
They didn't want to put a number in it because it was a prequel.
Right.
So I guess they didn't want to be confusing.
Before the thing. The birth of the thing. Well, for those people who haven't seen it, you don't have to, came out in 2011, they decided to make a prequel. It's basically what happens at this Norwegian camp before... They start jumping into helicopters and shooting at dogs. What's your take on it? I think you give me your take first before I tell you what I think.
Well, the first time I saw it, I was like, it's not necessary. Why are they doing this? And I could also nail CGI versus practical effects. And that kind of annoyed me considering that the original is so much better with practical effects. Upon second viewing, I didn't hate it as much. Because I realized that there was a lot of love put into it as far as trying to recreate sets and props from the first film that you see when they go to that station that's suddenly frozen over. And I do like how, you know, they end it right where the first one begins, you know, with the helicopter chasing the dog. But, you know, like most remakes and prequels, they're not really that necessary. It's like they're trying to give you more of what is really just a nostalgia-based feeling.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure, you know. It is what it is. It wasn't necessary.
Well, to me, it's a prequel done with a reboot mentality. So instead of coming up with a new adventure and new stories that could have happened to these Norwegians prior to all of this, even if you were creating great replicas, like going down the hallway to where the block of ice, where the creature was first brought in and escaped from, recreating the great dual-faced creature that mid-transformation that Batine had created, that Mac and Copper bring back to the American base. Keep those points, but then tell a different story. Tell different something unique, something about... The only thing really unique in this entire thing was that it couldn't absorb metal. I really thought that was a cool idea. So that immediately when I saw Dude's earring, I went, oh, okay, so he's not a thing. Because he's got an earring, and the thing can't recreate earrings.
You're talking about Childs at the end?
No. In the 2011 version, one of the things I don't like about it is, oh, thank God the Americans are here to save us, because they're the only people that live at the end are the Americans, and then the Norwegian lives. But the pilot has an earring, and that's how from the very first scene I saw it, I went, oh, okay, so he's not a thing. And then I kept looking for it.
And they, you know, use that now to say that in the original thing with the Carpenter version, that Childs couldn't be the thing because he had an earring at the end. But John Carpenter has joked that, of course, Childs is the thing. If you look carefully, you can't see his breath. And he's right. If you watch that last scene with him and MacReady, you can see MacReady's breath, but you cannot see Childs' breath.
Well, the other thing, too, and have you heard this about the glint in the eye theory? There is a theory online that if you go back and watch the thing, that are the thing don't... You can't see the glint in their eyes. There's a special... The way they do the lighting and the way Kundi does the lighting, you can always see a little faint flicker in all the humans' eyes, but you can't in the ones that are the thing.
I heard that it's most noticeable with Palmer on the couch. I think right. I read that somewhere.
Yeah. Palmer on the couch, Norris when he's in the hallway, and then the Childs at the end. Because you can't see his eyes. You can see MacReady's, but you can't see Childs. So there's that. But getting back to 2011, I just thought overall it's a reboot mentality. They tell the same kind of situation, the same kind of stories. The only thing they try to add different really is they try to add a female perspective, but then they don't give it a female perspective. Instead, they just give her a flamethrower. Seems like if you're going to have a female lead, they would have taken some kind of female kind of counterpoint to this masculinity, which is so prevalent in the other version. But they didn't. And they just made it, you know, even down to the same lines. We're going to figure out who's who. You could be one of those things. We don't know which of us is human. They add the whole stuff where they actually go into... The thing escapes enough to go back to the spaceship, and then they go back to the spaceship, and the thing starts powering it up. If it crashed 100,000 years ago, how's he powering it up, for one thing?
Yeah.
Why didn't he do that before?
And I read about some stuff they wanted to do in that movie, but I guess it was either too confusing or they didn't have the budget. But that really weird digitization thing there, you know what I'm talking about?
Yep.
Was supposed to be, I don't know, like a creature or something. And it was supposed to have, like, specimen cages of... It was like this ship had crashed there. And it was this ship that went around the universe taking specimens from different planets. And apparently the thing was one of the specimens that had escaped. And there were supposed to be, like, other specimens... You know, but they couldn't afford that, or it was too confusing or something. But I thought that was very interesting. I was like, why didn't they do that?
Yes, please. That's what I mean.
You know, that would add to the story and to the mythology of everything. You know,
right.
It would be something different. But when you say it has a reboot mentality, do you think they had intended to go further if it was successful?
No, I mean a reboot in the fact of we're going to take the same story, the same situation, the same action, and we're just going to like cast new faces in it and do this same kind of retelling, reimagining, reboot, blah, blah, blah. Not a reboot to kick a franchise. I guess remake might be a better way of saying it.
Maybe.
Or reimagining.
Makes me think of franchise. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because if they tried to remake the thing... You know, that would just be sacrilegious.
Well, I read one thing online that I think perfectly sums up the the 2011 The Thing prequel, which says, it's a glorified fan film that really loved the original and works too hard to imitate it. And I thought, okay, kind of cool the way the fact that he said imitates. But it is. It's a really cool fan film where you can tell they really liked the original. They recreated the sets. They recreate the monsters so it looks the same. This kind of stuff. But then they just do the same thing again. It's basically a bunch of... Except they show the creature way too much because they have CGI and they can. And it's not as effective. It's not as scary. The pacing is not there. None of the stuff that makes... To your point, there's no punctuation. There's no clever characterization. There's no unique lines or structure to it. And it doesn't have Carpenter's pace. So I think it falls really pretty flat when you compare it, especially.
Yeah, I can see it. Well, I mean, Carpenter has his own signature. I mean, on any film he does, good or bad.
Yeah.
I mean, you know it's a John Carpenter film, and this clearly is not.
True.
Yeah.
Okay, so I've got a list of just things that I think are keys, which are either they inspired John Carpenter's The Thing, or John Carpenter's The Thing have inspired them, so to speak. One of the ones, and I think you'll like this, is there was an X-Files episode called Ice.
Yeah, very first season.
And to me, it's like, we love John Carpenter, we're going to do an homage to him in the 90s. And, you know, it's the Arctic base with the alien, possibly alien, in the ice that, you know, attacks them. So very, very inspired, I think, by Carpenter's The Thing. I think there's a lot of alien in Carpenter's. I mean, there's a lot of alien-inspired stuff in Carpenter's. Starts out with a distress call, so to speak, sort of thing. And then it's the creature is in our house chasing us and we can't get away. We have no way out, sort of thing. They can't get to the mainland because everything's destroyed, and an alien, they can't go anywhere. They're in a spaceship, sort of thing. Some other classics we've talked about, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, Lovecraft and the Mountains of Madness.
Yeah, definitely.
I think there's a Ten Little Indians element kind of in there because it is one by one by one and one of us is a murderer kind of thing. Feel to it, that classic, you know, what do they call them? They call them a drawing room murder mystery because it's all kind of in one set sort of thing. I think there's a little Philip K. Dick in here, that paranoia of one of us is bad and wrong kind of thing. We mentioned the Lovecraft design. And then I had the Voorhees thing because I think that's an homage to, you know, I think Jason may have either taken his name or it just is happenstance that it turned out that way.
As far as keys, I'm thinking more along the literary line as to when, and I was going to try to Google it real quick, but I'm not having any luck. We were talking about Body Snatchers, and I'm not sure when that original Jack Finney novel was written.
Oh.
I think it was written after Who Goes There, but then somewhere along the lines, you've also got Day of the Triffids, which was a plant-based kind of monster,
yes,
which is what they kind of did with the Howard Hawks movie.
Yep,
so you've
very
got
good.
This weird amalgamation of three classic science fiction stories in at least the original film, the Howard Hawks version. But you've definitely got a Body Snatchers element, like you said, in the Carpenter version.
Well, and I have one very, very recent because I just watched the new movie called Life, the one with Jake Gyllenhaal aboard the...
Oh, I want to see that.
It's very, very Thing inspired. I think you will see the Thing all the way through it.
Is that in a good way or a bad way?
I liked it. I do think it has some issues, especially near the end and the third act, but it's a group of really witty, really nice, well-portrayed, great characters who are all isolated in the space station, and an alien life form becomes present. And it's what happens to them.
It
so
looks more like Alien to me than it does The Thing. Of course, all I'm seeing is a trailer. But
Yeah, well, I think it's only similar to Alien in the fact that it is in space. Mm. I think it has more to do with, you know, and again, I think the Carpenter's The Thing was very Alien-inspired because it did have these kind of working-class people talking witty and having their each of them with very unique, distinct characters. It's just, to me, I think Alien goes a lot farther in the fear factor than The Thing does. Gotcha.
For the record, Day of the Trippids was published in 1951, and Body Snatchers was published in 1955.
Mm.
Originally serialized in 54. So they came a good deal after Who Goes There. So you could say that Jack Finney and John Wyndham may have been inspired by Who Goes There.
Well, or Wyndham was inspired actually by the Nybee Hawks
film.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Hawks version. Yeah, exactly. Oh, look, they've done a giant rutabaga man. I will do a book about plants.
A giant plant with three legs that walks.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, you can see the connections there as well, for sure.
Yeah, I do. You kind of inspired me. I kind of made me think. It's interesting that they make no attempts at all to talk to the alien or to communicate with the alien in any way in both films. Actually, in all three films.
Well, no, the doctor does in the Howard Hawks. He's like, "We are your friends," or whatever. He's like trying to talk to it right before they electrocute it, isn't he?
Yeah, at the very end, he walks up to it saying, da da da. But
I am your buddy, don't kill me.
Before they attack it or set it on fire, or literally, and Carpenter set it on fire several times, or whatever, nobody makes any attempt to talk to it, to find out about it, to anything. They just go immediately, "Oh, it's a threat, kill it." So,
right.
And that could be good or bad. You know, I do hate the movies, too, where they, you know, like War of the Worlds. "I'm your friend. I'm holding up the Bible. Let me..." And it just laser blasts and nukes you.
Yeah.
You know. So...
I will disintegrate you.
Yes.
Yeah. Vaporize him now. But you know what? If I saw a spider crawling across my floor with eight legs, I wouldn't try to talk to it either. I would step on it.
okay.
And when I see, you know, a spider come out of a guy's head and it walks away, I think I would probably flamethrow it, for if that's a verb.
Well, you have a point there.
Torch like, it now.
I just saw this thing eat one of us. I don't think it wants to be friends. Yeah, so
Yeah. It's a little hostile.
A little hostile. I think it's feeling a little alone and nervous. Okay, cool. Do we have anything else to say? We definitely recommend the Carpenter version, yes?
Oh, yeah, without question. The Carpenter version is the one to see out of all of the versions we've talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And it stands alone. Too. You don't have to see the other ones. I mean, you can if you're like us because we're film junkies, but you really don't need to go any further. Unless you want to read the story. The story's kind of cool because, you know, it really is the closest to the story as well.
True. And if you want a good scare, get the soundtrack too, because it is just phenomenal.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Cool.
So... I guess that about wraps it up.
I think it should. We can add the outro here and decide on what we're doing next time.
Yeah, well, I guess I have to record those later unless...
Yeah, I think it's fine.
Okay.